What is it?
It's your future. It's called a Stargate.
Chevron 7 locked.
Welcome to Walking Through the Stargate. I'm Brent.
And I'm Zach.
This is episode 100. That's not 100. This is episode 203.
203.
You know, you say 100 often enough and it just becomes part of the muscle memory.
Yeah, right? About 100 times.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. But friends, no, we're in the 200s now. This is episode 203. And we'll be talking about Stargate SG-1's episode Collateral Damage.
Collateral Damage.
Mm-hmm. Friends, we are an independent podcast. And if you like what we've got going on, you could support the show at buymeacoffee.com/walkingthrough. Or you can go to our website at wtts.space.
Space.
Yeah, very nice. And click on the little coffee cup icon on the bottom right corner. There you can buy one or two or five or 10 or 100 coffees, however many you want. And if you really like what we've got going on, you can click on the little button at the very bottom that where it says walking through the Stargate. It takes you to buymeacoffee.com/walkingthrough. And there they have things called memberships, and memberships have many tiers. We only have the one. So if you'd really like to support our show on a monthly basis, you can sign up for a membership at $3 a month. And also in there are wish list items. There's a couple of normal wish list items, like some better microphones and a better mixer. But there's also a wish list item more for y'all and less for me. If you all wish to hear us watch two more episodes of the non-canonical animated series Stargate Infinity and record our reactions to each and then post each episode up on the main feed, you can support that wish list item. And once it funds, we will do just that. But we will not do that until it funds. Mwahahaha. So there's that.
I would like to point out, Brent, that yes. Mwahahaha is not in the show notes.
No, it is. It is not in the show notes at all. It is because I am secretly evil.
Mm-hmm. I can attest to that. It's true.
If anybody in your life wants to listen to this excellent Stargate content, you can recommend our show to them, and they can find us on all sorts of places like Spotify podcasts and Apple podcasts and iHeartRadio podcasts and Amazon podcasts. But they should take advantage of the federated technology that is known as podcast aggregators, and they go and find themselves a podcast alligator. Search for Walking Through the Stargate, subscribe to our show there, and once we drop the delicious episodes through our RSS feed, they will get it as quickly as the RSS feed refreshes. It's just going to be, from their point of view, basically instant. But there you go. Zach?
Yes, Brent?
If a person wants to let us know that sometimes my segues are just flawless and sometimes they act as if it's a crepe, just loose and floppy and not holding any shape, but still somehow tasty. How might they reach out and let us know?
Well, if you have recipes for various and sundry breakfasty or dessert options, you can let us know by emailing us at walkingthroughthestargate@gmail.com, which is walkingthroughthestargate@gmail.com.
We haven't done that in a while.
I know.
Yeah.
But, you know, every once in a while, you got to throw it in there.
Yeah.
You know.
Just to make sure.
Just to make sure. Because some people are bad spellers.
Mm-hmm. We also might have changed the spelling at one point.
That's true. I suppose it's conceivable. We haven't. Yes. But it could happen.
Yes, that's right.
You know, maybe we just go THRU for through.
Please no.
So never mind.
it's the inevitable trend of language. 500 years in our future, it will be spelled THRU, and everyone will be like, it's spelled THRU, you ding dongs. THROUGH is like some archaic spelling.
It is, but that's beside the point.
And I will be like rolling over in my grave going, but it's the right way.
You know, the right way isn't the only way.
Deep thoughts.
Yes.
With walking through the Stargate.
Yes. Now, it's even deeper when I kind of come down here and get this dark, deep sound and say,
okay,
the right way isn't always the only way.
Wow.
Now it's especially deep.
Yeah.
And if you, dear listeners, want to participate in this lovely content,
yeah,
email us at Walking Through the Stargate. Join us on Facebook. Find us on our website, WTTS.space.
Space.
Go to our Discord and join the conversation there. There's a cool link on that on our website if you don't already have it. And, of course, if you want to support this stuff, go to Buy Me a Coffee. We do need to give thanks to Julian, supported us and bought some coffees for us since the last time we recorded. So thank you very much, Julian. Appreciate
it. Thank you, Julian. Yeah. It's
and,
great.
Julian is a relatively new listener to the podcast, and he joined the Discord, and that's how we know that it's him. So join the Discord because it's fun.
Yes, it is very fun.
All right. Brent.
Yes.
Collateral Damage.
Yes.
Shall we dig into it?
Yeah, let's dive in.
Because there might be people who are stranded underneath all of this damage.
Oh, no. Let's go get them.
Let's go get them. Well, the director is there. His name is William Waring.
Yes.
This is his third of three directing credits this season.
Mm-hmm.
He did The Ties That Bind, The Powers That Be, and then Collateral Damage. And now he's safe and secure. He's safe.
He's good.
He's good. The teleplay is by Joseph Malazzi and Paul Mully. This is their fourth of seven writing credits this season. They did The Ties That Bind, Ex Deus Machina, and The Fourth Horseman, Part 2.
Yes.
And they've got a few more coming up, so they're still kind of mired in the collateral damage of stuff.
Yeah, they're still pretty busy.
Yep. We have a ton of guest actors.
Oh, yeah.
First and foremost, we have to say hello to a friend of the show, Gary Jones, who is Chief Master Sergeant Walter Radar Harriman. Then we have Anna Galvin, who plays Dr. Rhea Varick.
Mm-hmm.
She was born in 1969 in Melbourne, Australia.
Mm-hmm.
She is known for Tin Man in 2007, Warcraft in 2016, and The Sentinel in 96.
Mm-hmm.
She's apparently a graduate of the Oxford School of Drama, so good on her.
Mm-hmm.
And her first IMDb credit came in 1994 when she was in the TV series New Voices for one episode, the episode Driven. She plays the character Jesse.
Mm-hmm.
Then we have Warren Kimmel, who plays Dr. Morell, the real killer.
Yeah. Wow.
He is known for SG-1 and Supernatural and The Collector.
Mm-hmm.
His first first IMDb credit was The Collector in 2005, which is only just a year or so before this episode aired. Just
Hanging
there. He played the character Obergruppenführer Brach.
Mm.
In the episode called The History, The Historian.
Uh-huh. Supergroup leader.
Yeah. Oof.
Yeah.
We have Benson Simmons, who plays Dr. Amuro, the short one.
Yeah.
The tall bearded one versus the short bearded one.
Yes.
Completely different.
Yeah, very different.
Now,
one was tall and one was short.
Well, exactly. He's known for SG-1, Applaud or Die.
Oh, my.
And Total Recall 2070.
Ah, okay.
His first IMDb credit came in 1989 in the TV series War of the Worlds. He played a busboy in the episode So Shall Ye Reap.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
We'll continue on with Ian Robison, who plays Frank Mitchell.
Yep.
He played a security officer in season 2 in the episode In the Line of Duty.
Mm-hmm.
We'll actually see Frank Mitchell in a future episode.
He'll return.
His first IMDb credit came in the Ray Bradbury Theater in 1992. He played Lieutenant Lee Rollins in the episode The Earthmen, but it was an uncredited role.
Okay.
And then we have to mention Maximilian Uhren, who plays the young Mitchell.
Mm-hmm.
And this was, in fact, his only IMDb credit.
Aha.
And now you may be thinking that I skipped somebody, and I didn't. I was just leaving William Atherton for last.
Yes.
William Atherton plays Emissary Varta. Incidentally, the name Varta never actually is voiced on screen,
but
it's in like the credits and all that stuff. So
sure.
So he's Emissary Varta, but he's only ever known as the Emissary. Now, anyway.
Yep.
He has a mini biography written by CAD, K-A-D, CAD.
Uh-huh, okay.
I haven't read this yet, so we'll see what happens.
Okay.
William Atherton's career has spanned motion pictures, Broadway, and television. He first appeared He first achieved international recognition as the leading man in Steven Spielberg's debut feature, The Sugarland Express, in 1974, and next starred in John Schlesinger's The Day of the Locust in 1975, Robert Wise's The Hindenburg, and Richard Brooks's Looking for Mr. Goodbar.
Mm-hmm.
He is known worldwide for what have become his signature film characters, the television reporter Dick Thornburg in the action blockbusters Die Hard and Die Hard 2.
Uh-huh.
The EPA official Walter Peck in Ghostbusters.
Uh-huh.
And Professor Jerry Hathaway, the conniving professor in Real Genius.
Mm-hmm.
And Dr. Noah Faulkner, the mad scientist in Biodome.
Mm-hmm.
Among his more than 30 feature films are co-starring roles in John Landis's Oscar, Bill Duke's Hoodlum, Richard Pierce's No Mercy, Alan Pakula's The Pelican Brief, mm-hmm. Costa Garvis's Mad City, and Edward Zwick's The Last Samurai.
Okay.
I'm guessing that this was a mini biography that was written, let's see here, in the early 2010s, in the teens.
Probably so.
All right. So on television, he has starred in numerous miniseries, including the classic Western Centennial, and headed the all-star cast in Malibu.
Mm-hmm.
His many made-for-TV movies include leading roles in TNT's production of Joan Didion's Broken Trust and his portrayal of Daryl F. Zanuck in HBO's Golden Globe winner Introducing Dorothy Dandridge. Atherton was a recurring series lead opposite Damian Lewis in NBC TV's Life and portrayed Principal Reynolds in the first season of Lost.
Uh-huh.
He has reprised his role as Walter Peck in the video game Ghostbusters in 2009, which was released in 2009.
Yeah, and isn't he in the new one that's coming out here soon? Or
could be. I haven't seen the new Ghostbusters.
I think that the new one is basically just a giant nostalgia festival.
Well, is it Ghostbusters and is it not the first one? Because if it is Ghostbusters and it is not the first one, then it is a giant nostalgia fest.
Not necessarily.
Which one isn't a giant nostalgia fest?
So if you're not getting my reference right away, then you probably have not seen or barely recall the one that came out, 5 years ago with an entirely new cast. Gosh, I can't remember. Why am I forgetting?
The one with...
I can't think of anybody's names. Oh.
No, so I did see that, but that one also had, like, as many of the original cast members popping in for something.
Yeah, but not in their original roles.
Well, fair enough. It was still
close
enough. Anyway. Anyway, Ghostbusters.
Yeah.
Atherton is delightful delightfully skeezy in the first one.
Yes. Okay, I had to look it up. And as soon as I look it up, I'm like, wow, my brain is not firing on all cylinders. It's Melissa McCarthy, Kristen Wiig, Kate McKinnon, and Leslie Jones.
As there you
in,
go.
Like, yeah, these are huge names. And I'm just like, why did I not remember any of them?
Because yeah, it's like Melissa McCarthy was the name that I was struggling to come up. I was like,
and then there's a ka-ka-ka, and there's another ka-ka-ka, and then there's a la-la-la.
I'm like, she was on the Gilmore Girls. I remember that because Julie watched the Gilmore Girls a lot.
Oh, anyway.
Wow, anyway, so as for Atherton's stage stuff, consistently honored for his work on the stage, Atherton has created roles on and off Broadway for many of America's leading playwrights. These include the title role in Joseph Papp's original production of David Rabe's The Basic Training of Pavlo Hummel,
mm-hmm.
the role of Ronnie in John Guare's The House of Blue Leaves, and Bing Ring Ling in his Rich and Famous.
Mm.
He has also starred in the Broadway premiere of Arthur Miller's The American Clock and the Tony-winning revival of Herman Wouk's the Kane Mutiny Court Martial. Among his more than 20 well-known productions are the acclaimed New York premieres of Franz Kafka's The Castle and Crespin Taylor's Address Unknown. For his work on the stage, he has received the Drama Desk Award, the Outer Circle Critics Award, the Theater World Award, and nominations for an Obie and Chicago's Joseph Jefferson Award.
Mm-hmm.
Suffice it to say, he's done a lot.
Yes, indeed.
But his first IMDb credit came in the movie The New Centurions. In 1972, he played the character of Johnson.
Johnson!
Johnson! That's all. All right. The original air date for Collateral Damage was January 13, 2006. Number one on the charts in the U.S. We were listening to Laffy Taffy by D4L.
We were?
Apparently.
I have no idea who D4L is.
Nor do I.
I mean, it's playing right now. That's nice.
Yeah, I'm going to guess this is Laffy Taffy, so it's got to be some sort of like cotton candy song.
Oh, okay.
You know, I'm imagining something that you would hear in one of the versions of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
Okay. Yeah.
Maybe some Oompa Loompas are singing Laffy Taffy along with D4L.
I see.
Maybe
that makes sense.
D4L is actually the production number of one of the Oompa Loompas.
Oh yeah, that could be. It's just right there. It's like, you know, you look at his identification card.
Yeah,
and he looks just like everybody else. Yeah.
D4L instead of D3L or you know
D4M
A7B.
Yeah. Right.
You know, et cetera, et cetera. and the UK, they're just doing their own thing. They're still listening to That's My Goal by Shane Ward. Who cares?
Yeah, yep. I was pretty much right on the money with my prediction of what That's My Goal was, more or less.
Yeah, I don't
The only
remember.
Difference being that Shane Ward is trying to get back somebody.
Ah, yeah.
But it's still just about, you know, it's a crooner.
Yeah, all right. Anyway, in the box office for this week of January 13th, we're watching Glory Road.
Okay.
And Last Holiday. I'm not going to try to make a story of this because
this is just going to be a list.
Hoodwinked.
Uh-huh. Okay.
The Chronicles of Narnia, The Lion, The Witch, and the Wardrobe.
Okay.
And Hostel.
All right.
Yeah. Yeah. No, no, I'm not going to try that.
Nope.
Nope. Okay. What was happening at this point in time? Well, a lot was happening on January 12th, the day before this episode aired. It was a Thursday. There is a stampede during the Stoning the Devil ritual on the last day at the Hajj in Mina, Saudi Arabia.
Mm-hmm.
It kills at least 362 Muslim pilgrims.
Bummer.
Ouch.
Yeah.
Ugh, okay. The French warship Clemenceau reaches Egypt and is barred access to the Suez Canal. They had Greenpeace activists board the ship.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Also on the 12th, the foreign ministers of the United Kingdom, France, and Germany declare the negotiations with Iran over, declare that negotiations with Iran over its nuclear program have reached a dead end and recommend that Iran be referred to the United Nations Security Council, which is probably why the Clemenceau was moving through the Suez Canal.
Yeah.
Also on the 12th, Turkey releases Mehmet Ali Agca from jail after he served 25 years for shooting Pope John Paul II.
Uh-huh, okay.
So that was happening all on the 12th.
Mm-hmm, busy day.
Busy day. On the 13th, the actress who played Anne Frank in the episode, in the movie The Diary of Anne Frank weds, at the age of 85, weds Jerry DeFord. Just a few hours before she dies on the 14th.
Okay.
So she was 85, and I wanted to get some more information about that, but I didn't get a chance to. Other roles that she was in Lolita, A Place in the Sun, A Patch of Blue, The Poseidon Adventure, etc., etc. So, big name. Just before she dies, she marries.
Yep. Okay.
And then on January 16th, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf is sworn in as Liberia's new president. She becomes the first first female elected head of state in Africa.
Uh-huh. Okay.
There you go.
There you have it.
I have some trivia for this episode.
Okay.
This episode is dedicated to Jeff Upton, who,
yes, I noticed
up
that.
Until his death, worked as the chief lighting technician on the series. So he was the gaffer. And in fact, so this is an interesting episode where they filmed it in two bits because they had like vacation for the crew in the middle. So they, mm-hmm. they did like week one of recording stuff, and then everybody went on vacation, and then they came back, and then they finished recording it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was in that interim time where Jeff passed away.
Oh, bummer. Ouch.
They didn't specify what or how or why or any of that stuff, but
sure.
In the original story idea, when they were in the writer's room and all that stuff, they had Teal'c being the one charged with a crime he didn't commit and all of that stuff.
Yeah.
But then they decided that Teal'c has had and, you know, will have, you know, some good story arcs with the Jaffa and all of that stuff. And so they used Mitchell for this to give some opportunity to explore some of his past.
Okay. Sure.
Yeah. So at the very end of the episode, we have that flashback where Mitchell is walking through the park with his father, and he's talking about whether he wants to leave the Air Force or whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in the background, there is a girl throwing a frisbee, and that is Tatiana Shanks, the daughter of mm-hmm. Michael Shanks.
Mm-hmm.
And Vaitar Bandera, who played Share.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, remember when Share was pregnant with the Harsis's child?
Yeah.
Well, Vaitar was actually pregnant, and Tatiana was the baby that she was pregnant with at that time.
Uh-huh.
So, there you go.
So, now am I not only feeling old, I'm feeling older, because this episode is 20 years old.
Yes, you know, and so, you know, she was probably, what, 8 or yeah. so in this episode yeah. when she was throwing that frisbee in the background.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Yep.
All right. So, this episode title in English is Collateral Damage.
Uh-huh.
Most everybody else in the world just calls it collateral damage in their respective languages.
Uh-huh.
The Czech, on the other hand, call it Parallel Memories.
Oh, that's a pretty good title.
Yeah. There you go. Parallel like Memories.
Yep.
All right. So, are you ready for the synopsis?
Yes. Let's dive in.
All right. We're going to dive into this. This is the synopsis that I found on the Stargate fandom wiki. I was throwing this through various ChatGPT options and couldn't find one that I liked. It was uh-huh. too silly or not enough detail or whatnot. And so then I ran out of time. And so here we are.
That's the thing that happens when you use large language models regularly. You start to realize that they are limited. They've got a few really neato party tricks, and that's about it.
Yeah, yeah. All right, so here it is. SG-1 establishes diplomatic relations with the Galarans, a moderately advanced human civilization that has enjoyed generations of peace under the Asgard Protected Planets Treaty. SG-1 discovers that the scientists of this world have recently built a device based on Gul'wul technology that can implant the memories of one person into another, remove memories, or even create new ones. Well, I can create new memories. Who needs a device for that?
Duh, I mean, come on.
Oh, yeah. All right. They believe that the device could revolutionize their society with the knowledge of one generation quickly and easily passed on to the next, reducing the time and cost of educating a new generation of people. Lieutenant Colonel Cameron Mitchell experiences the astonishing technology firsthand as a demonstration to the rest of SG-1. Mitchell strikes up a relationship with the head of the project, Dr. Rhea Varick. This platonic relationship quickly becomes a romantic one when Cameron consoles her after she discovers that the military plans on taking over the project. She invites him back to her apartment, where they share a drink, and she comes on to him. When he wakes up in the morning, he finds himself in her apartment with blood on his hands and apparently remembers committing the murder.
Mm-hmm.
The authorities arrest Mitchell, but he's pardoned by Emissary Varta in an attempt to maintain negotiations between this world and Earth. Mitchell turns down the pardon and pushes for an investigation, believing that his memory of the murder is false and probably implanted in his mind with the memory device. This puts him in a dangerous position, as the penalty for murder, if convicted, would be death. With the aid of two scientists involved in the project, Amuro and Morel, Cameron is hooked up to the machine and is prepared to scan the suspect memory to determine if it's false. Before they begin, the scientists use two important real memories from Mitchell's past to establish a baseline. It is here that a part of his life is revealed. It's revealed that his father, Frank Mitchell, was a test pilot for the United States Air Force until he lost both his legs in an accident. And we also learned that he was about 10 when the first space shuttle was launched in 1981.
Mm-hmm.
After enduring the process of watching the memory of the murder repeatedly, it's discovered that the memory looks real. This angers Morel, who is revealed to be married but separated from Rhea. Oh my gosh.
Oh no.
Now, Teal'c and Daniel Jackson, meanwhile, are searching for clues in Dr. Varick's records, but are frustrated that parts of it are censored. When Varta reveals that the results of the memory scans and suggests the possibility of sending Mitchell back to Earth and covering up the murder, Daniel responds by threatening to prevent an alliance between Earth and Varta's world. Back in the lab, Mitchell undergoes the memory scan again, this time using a memory with similar emotional content to the murder so as to compare the results. They use a memory of him using an F-16 Fighting Falcon to bomb targets which had, at the time, been identified as enemy targets, only to learn that they were, in fact, innocent refugees immediately after launching his missiles. Yep, once you hit that button, you can't unlaunch the missile.
Yep.
It's launched. With the comparison of two occasions where Mitchell has killed innocent people available to them, the scans are able to discover an inaccuracy in the memory, proving that Mitchell is indeed innocent.
Uh-huh.
At Mitchell's insistence, however, Morel scans deeper to try to uncover the identity of the real killer. I would like to point out that it is not try and uncover, it is try to uncover.
Yes.
Morel scans deeper to try to uncover the identity of the real killer. In the memory, Cameron sees his reflection in a mirror, but the face is blurry, an indication that his mind is having trouble processing seeing a face that isn't his in the mirror. Going even deeper, the face is soon revealed. It's Morel's face!
Oh, no!
Oh, yes! Disconnecting from the memory device, Mitchell reveals his discovery, but he, Lieutenant Colonel Samantha Carter, and Amuro find that Morel erased his own memory of killing Rhea after implanting it in Cameron's mind. Oh my.
Mm-hmm.
Later, the memory is removed from Mitchell's mind, and the team discovers that Morel's memory has been altered so that he now believes that Rhea was killed in an accident. Bummer. At the SGC, Mitchell talks to Major General Hank Landry, who knows about his past because he has read Mitchell's service record, and it's revealed that Mitchell nearly resigned as a result of that F-16 accident, but his father convinced him not to resign. The mm-hmm. end.
The end.
So, Brent.
Yes.
Collateral damage.
Mm-hmm.
What are your thoughts?
So, there is a lot about this episode that is middling at best. There's a lot.
Okay.
There is, there's aspects of how the show was shot based off of what was said on the page that just kind of stood out like a sore thumb, that were needlessly weird. One quick example was that when Mitchell and what's her name?
Varick. Rhea Varick.
When Mitchell and Varick go to Varick's house and he's all like, "Holy cow, this is weird. It's like I was just here." And she goes, "Yeah, well, then you probably know where the drinks are." She's like leaning against the bar. Like, I mean, I suppose a person could say that phrase when leaning against the bar, but it's just a little bit. It was just a little weird. It's just like a little too on the nose versus the idea of having them move a little bit further into the set and then having her say that line. And then he goes to the bar. That would be a little bit more impactful. Like he actually remembers where the drinks are versus literally seeing them. There was another aspect of the like memory editing with Dr. Moreau, Dr. Merrill, that was a little clunky. It just felt a little weird. But and then there was just the aspects of the story where it's like, you know, they were trying to definitely signal that the bad guy is Varta. And they did that over and over again. And then, of course, there was the twist. And but then there was plenty of parts that were actually quite good. I thought that how they did the face reveal, I'm pretty sure they shot that a few times where it's shot with Mitchell, you know, shot with Browder, mm-hmm. Ben Browder. It's shot again with Varta. I'm pretty sure they shot it with Varta. And then they shot it with Merrill. So that when they did that face reveal thing, it went through, like, you know, because there was a beat where it was looking like an awful lot like Varta's face. And I think that was on purpose, obviously, right? Because this whole time we're kind of convinced that it's Varta who did the killing. And then, oh, no, it's a twist. It was Merrill. Oh, no. Then there was also the really good part of that Vartle was really the bad guy the whole time, because like, what happens at the end? Like, complete manipulation, absolute manipulation, where in the interest of a scientific program, they decide to hijack this guy's mind, falsely implant the idea that his wife was killed was killed in an accident because they need this program to keep going.
Yeah.
Right. Because they can't have the work stop. And so here we have an emissary who will use every tool at his disposal in order to continue what he thinks is the thing to go forward and not to just deal with life as it happens. So there was, like I mentioned, there was plenty that was kind of like fine. And as I was immediately after, in the aftermath of watching the episode, I was kind of like, yeah, this was fine. But as a person tends to do when watching an episode about memories, I immediately started thinking about high school libraries.
Okay.
Yeah. And how memory is it's very infallible. It's not kind of infallible. I'm sorry, not infallible. The other way around. Fallible.
Very fallible.
Thank you. It's very fallible. Not the other way around of kind of fallible. And I thought that there was a pretty decent line in there about how, like, you know, yeah, misremembering a license plate is very different than having your memory of 4 years of college be a lie. Because I think that it kind of highlights the extremes about what we are talking about with this one, but also ignores the reality that we learn more and more about it when it comes to human memory, about how, you know, as time goes on, when we are recalling things, we are recalling the last time we recalled it. And therefore, over time, it starts to take a bend. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. It bends in a certain way, depending on a whole lot of contexts. Like, you know, like, it's not predictable. It's in its own way, it's very organic. But the point is that it moves away from what actually transpired. And it got me thinking about about memory's place in societies. So the reason why I was thinking about that was because at the very end, we have, you know, this emissary who is purposefully tampering with memories in order to keep an aspect of his society going, specifically the research. But, you know, this goal, this thing that a group of people have decided is really important and should be attempted, should go for it. You know, the very first thing that crosses my mind right now, which is weird, but whatever, it's like the Apollo program. It's something that we decided we're going to do with our time and money and effort and talent.
Right.
We are going to build a rocket and put people on the top of that rocket, and we're going to launch it into another body, and we're going to safely land it on another body and then get them back. Like, that was what we were going to do. And so we spent tons of time and money on that effort. Just gobs. And so this is kind of like a moonshot, at least I'm seeing. Like, this is something that is so important that the emissary is willing to tamper with somebody's experience in order to keep it going. It just got me thinking about experience in society, as I mentioned, like memory in society. Like, you know, imagine the first bridge builders, right? You're, you know, somebody, there's land here, there's land there, there's a river in the middle. And they kind of figure out how to put sticks across, you know, boards and better boards and different boards. And then at one point, they completely screw it up, right? They only have so many boards. So they try to get away with it, and then they move an ox cart across it and it falls down. And then they learn they got to build it bigger. And so they build it bigger. And, you know, that is one, that's something that we point to as, you know, the progression of a society through experience. And we like to think that it is linear, that, you know, one thing leads to the next, that memory is really, really rock solid, because we can point at a bridge and go, at some point, somebody remembered how screwed up the previous bridge was and therefore figured out how to make it better. And this is an example of how memory then serves society. La, 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 la. Well, yes, but the aspect of society getting supercharged, I argue, is when they started to document things. That documentation starts to be the real launching point to where a society can progress quickly or meaningfully or powerfully or and it's because documentation is still susceptible to biases, but what it is not susceptible is drift. Once it is written down, if it's preserved, it's there. If you're recording the experience of what happened when you built a bridge and you record what materials you used and how you built it, then later somebody else can go back and go, oh, I see your problem here. Or, oh, that was a good idea. Let's refine it. Or, you know what I mean? Like that becomes a thing, right? Documentation. And how we tend to think that our engagement, our involvement, our guidance of our society, our civilization, our culture, our community is based off of our experience. And we tend to value experience. And we think that experience is something that is to be lauded over documentation, data, and understanding. And then you get some young whippersnappers in there who have studied a bunch of stuff, and they come in all snot-nosed and thinking that they're better than you and saying what we actually should do is we should use this newfangled thing called steel to build a bridge. And you're just like, you do not have the experience I have in building bridges. There is nothing better than rocks. And, you know, you end up having ego in the way, et cetera, et cetera. You know, like we have a tendency to go that way. And we also have a tendency to be jerks about it when we have smarty pants in the room. I'm not saying that this is flawless, but I'm just acknowledging that we need records to keep ourselves going. Here we have a story of what would it be like if a society was susceptible to having all of its memories manipulated? We saw this was the very faintest taste of that idea. The faintest taste. And it's a very interesting idea. And it got me thinking, obviously, as I'm rattling on about this thing. And you know that when I start to go on about these weird kind of societal or philosophical questions that kind of are barely related to the episode, that I tend to be like, yeah, I had a great time. It was really great. I really enjoy when I watch an episode and it gets me thinking along these lines quite a lot. Yeah. And it gets me thinking about the inherent problem that at some point there's going to be documentation. And if Meryl runs across the documentation of the murder, he's going to be like, wait a minute, what's up with this? Like, what? This is going completely contrary to the thing that you were telling, or whatever. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
that whole thing. So why did it make me think about high school libraries? It's because the high school library is kind of the first, at least in the United States, it's kind of the first instance, maybe a middle school library, but high school libraries for sure. It's the first instance where you have the opportunity to have this meaningful connection or intersection between documentation of things. I'll use the word facts, but I really kind of mean it in the form of like evidence of all kinds, but okay. Strong, very strong evidence, along with the opportunity to think critically about it and to examine and to then leapfrog off of the shoulders of the people that were documenting and thinking about this stuff before. as maybe middle school is a little bit that, but, you know, but the elementary libraries, I mean, it's much more about, like, you know, the familiarity with the structure and definitely, you know, exposure to literature and, you know, perhaps some, you know, rudimentary learning of some basics and some, you know, some social emotional stuff and some, you know, rudimentary, like, you know, historical context stuff and some story stuff. You know, it's real. It's really basic. And, you know, of course, your university library is it's that idea on speed. It's not the elementary one, but, you know, the evidence one. Like, it's just the stacks are chocked full of people that are going on and on about the evidence that they have about a certain idea. And boy, can it get really dry. But if you are really interested in a particular conversation, that's where you go. That's how you connect with that conversation and understand what people have thought about it before and then bring your own thoughts to the conversation as well. Which is completely not what this episode was about. It had nothing to do with documentation. It had nothing to do with records. But it just made me think about that in a way that was very solid and connected and being like, yaha, like, we think that our memories are the thing that are core to a society advancing to degrees. And in fact, it's actually kind of the opposite. It's our ability to take documentation, incorporate it into our thinking based off of our experience. I mean, I'm not saying it's not all there, but I'm just acknowledging, like, what I think my experience was of my four college years now, many years later, is probably similar or, you know, in large degrees, probably very similar to what I experienced during those 4 years. But I got to tell you, every now and again, I'll come across something and a memory from one of my 4 years in college just pop up out of nowhere. And I'll be like, whoa, I haven't thought about that in forever. And it's, you know, it's a thing that I completely forgot about. So my 4 years of college, bringing it back to Daniel's point, are actually inside my head a complete construct. Yeah, I did it. Yes, there's experience in there. And yes, it formed who I am as a person. There's no question about it. And there's a piece of paper that documented that I did it and successfully completed it in a certain time frame. But to Daniel's criticism, that memory at this point, it might as well be something that somebody pushed inside my head. Like, it's not as concrete as what it was kind of implied in that statement. So I'm wrapping it up by saying this whole tangent kind of came up after the conclusion of watching this episode, which I thought was delightful. I really had a nice time kind of thinking through this whole thing and enjoying it and kind of excited to be bringing this whole thing up, which is very little to do with the episode entirely. I thought the episode was fine. I thought the twist was fine. I thought that the wrap up was fine. I thought that the sort of the aspect of the real bad guy still being Varda, but in a different way, was fun. I thought that it was shot really well. I thought that the actors did a fine job. It was fine. And then I had a whole lot of fun thinking about this other tangential thing.
Yeah.
So what did you think about this episode after watching it?
So let me respond to some of the things that I remember you saying.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
One of the things that creates personality and, like, individuality in humans is less about the memory of an event, but the emotional resonances of those events.
Mm-hmm.
They actually mention things like that in this episode, but it's kind of tangential. This is why PTSD is such a big deal,
mm-hmm.
right? Because, you know, with PTSD, you have a traumatic event, and then you begin to emotionally relive that after triggers.
Yeah.
And so, like, this is where memory and emotion interconnect with each other.
Mm-hmm.
I learned a lot in seminary. I learned a lot in undergrad. I don't remember hardly any of the particulars of that, but it did create a lattice and a foundation upon which I can understand and interpret various things that come into my world today.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, that's what memories are. So, you know, I mean, I remember hearing about a class, you know, if somebody in your church says this and this, a good way of responding is like this.
Mm-hmm.
And now I walk into a situation and I see somebody saying something or doing something, and I'm like, oh, I remember that triggers that memory. It's not really the memory so much as the emotion of that. And now I'm like, okay, so how can I convey that emotion within this situation?
Mm-hmm.
And that's where memory conveyance and learning comes in. And then, you know, if I do my job well, somebody can learn from my experiences by hearing about it and doing it. It gets messy.
Sure does.
Well, I guess one of the things is like, you know, if you were to all of a sudden dump somebody else's memories, I'll use that in quotes,
yeah,
of their college experience into my head, that changes who I am.
Right.
Because yes, now their emotional connections to the memories and all of that stuff are now bouncing around in my head. And now the question is, can I trust that? I mean, I can trust that the feelings that I had about my past, my memories, are accurate in that they establish who I am. They create that lattice. Can I be certain that on, you know, January 13th, 2006, I was doing something in particular without that documentation that you talked about? No.
Right.
I can't do that. But that doesn't mean that whatever I did on January 13, 2006 wasn't integral to ultimately who I am.
No, now, yeah.
I don't.
Yeah.
As far as I know, there was nothing important that was happening at that point in time. I was probably starting January 6th.
I mean, this is where it gets interesting. You're thinking about what you were doing. I looked it up because that's one of the reasons I like photos.
I don't have enough photos. I can't do that.
On January 13th, 2006, I was taking a picture of my cat.
Ah, in January 13th, 2006, I was either getting ready or in a class on intermediate Greek.
Yeah, yeah.
And
so, but I mean, like, it's in no way, there is no right or wrong. In no way are you right or wrong in how you are talking about this, nor am I. It's this, we have mythology that we build up about ourselves, about others. We tend to think that the mythology that we've built up, where we have literally participated in it, is much more rock solid than somebody else's mythology. But to your earlier point of, you recall that in a class, you were told when a parishioner does this, respond like that. And odds are great that you probably remembered it with great fidelity. But there's a meaningful chance. Sure, there's a meaningful chance that you misremembered something. It's working. You know what I mean? Like, you know, if you misremembered something, you tried to employ it and it wasn't working really well, you'd be like, whoa, that's screwed up. And you would pivot and you probably would forget that piece of advice, like, because right, it didn't work. And so you were trying something else. There's a small chance that you misremembered. You are employing the misremembrance. It's working. And therefore, you in your mind go, yes, I was told that by this person around this time in this context. And it's possible that that person did not say that at all. It matters.
My contention is that for today, it doesn't matter.
Right. It matters. It doesn't matter. Right. It matters in so much as if we are envisioning a science fiction-y type of a thing where people are, where their personality basically is constructed,
mm-hmm,
through the use of memory. It matters because this is either really understanding that memories don't build a person quite like Lego bricks, and therefore you just kind of end up with a stew. And so you put the ingredients in the stew and you're pretty sure it's going to result in a person going in that direction, but maybe not, but whatever, it's close enough and you're fine with that. Or this science fiction idea completely misunderstands how memories actually construct a person, and it's kind of going down the wrong path of, it's not bricks in a wall, right? Like, you can't build a person by artificially putting in memories inside their head.
And I think the answer is probably somewhere in between. And I think this, mm-hmm, episode, actually, getting back to this episode, invites us to examine that and think about that, because they do talk about a, you know, your memory is not as reliable as you think it is.
Right. Yes.
They acknowledge that. And Morel and Amuro talk about, you know, it's not quite the same as, you know, you can't just pick a memory out and examine it like it's, you know, a phone or a baseball, yeah, or something. You know, I can't just pick it up and look at it. It's more than that. They talk about needing some baseline memories to kind of see, yeah, you know, how does this particular brain respond to memories of seminal memories like this and that and that. And now we're getting something to compare data against. And mm-hmm, even that, it's messy and unclear. And even the whole thing with the blurry face and the distorted face, our brains are really good at just making it work.
Yeah, oh yeah.
And so, yep, if you shove a memory into my head of somebody else, then absolutely my brain is going to manipulate that so that if I'm supposed to be seeing things POV, then when I look in a mirror of POV, I'm going to make sure that whatever I see is me.
Yeah.
And either that's because I change my mental perception of who I am, or I change the mental perception of what I'm seeing in that video or in that mirror, that reflection, so that it reflects who I am or my mental perception of who I am. It gets complicated. Yeah. So this episode does an interesting job of delving into that and playing with that and checking at that. And then, of course, you've got the morality of you know, I mean, I guess I get it. Morel doesn't have the memory of killing her.
Right.
We can't recover that memory of killing her.
Sure.
It's assumed that this death was based on jealousy, emotions, or whatnot. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it appears like this is probably a one-time event.
Yeah, but this is another one of those middling parts of the story.
Oh, sure. But I mean, it's just all it and all that stuff. You know, like, what do you do with this guy? I mean, you could throw him in jail, but he has no recollection of that. And I mean, what I actually at that point in time, I felt more for Amuro.
Oh yeah,
because he knows work with this it guy. All.
That's right, and that's where I think that the episode kind of dropped the ball a little bit. It yeah. couldn't really pick the ball up. This is too deep of a concept. But like, what do you do with culpability at that point, right? Like, at this point, Morel is effectively incompetent to stand and accept the consequences of his actions.
Yeah.
Right? Like, functionally, this is like, he is legally insane for purposes of culpability and consequence.
Yeah.
When we have individuals in our society who are legally insane and cannot understand the consequences of their actions, we societally go, well, there's really no point in doing anything about it. And it can be very dissatisfying to the people who have been negatively affected by this thing, who want retributive justice and who are then living their entire lives with this weight on their shoulders of how they have been negatively affected by this person, and this person has absolutely no idea that they did it. So yeah. Bringing it back to Murrow, I mean, you're exactly right. Like, you know, and what about, what's her face's family?
Yeah.
I mean, right? Like, and this is, again, where the episode is a bit middling because you can't really delve into the tendrils of this thing without really losing the whole point you're trying to say. You can't tell this story well in 43 minutes. You can't. There's just too many things. But unfortunately, all the things, when you start thinking about it, are still there. They're still out there, and they haven't been even remotely addressed. And therefore, it's less. It turns into less of a story about what I think it's trying to be a story about, and more just 43 minutes of character exposition of Mitchell, which is fine.
Which is really all they're ultimately what they're going for is to provide an opportunity to thicken up the backstory of who
yeah.
Cameron Mitchell is.
Yeah. So we got that.
And it does that. And it does it well, you know, and I actually like what we see there, right?
Yes.
We see a guy who has some risk-taking kind of in his blood. He gets that from his dad. His dad's an Air Force test pilot, gets injured when Mitchell was relatively young, and so that's, you know, that's a significant piece to the puzzle.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, you've got the memory of him doing what military pilots have to do, and they go in there and they drop the bomb on the bad guys.
Yeah.
And then it turns out, yep, you're good to go. Okay. You sure? Yep. 100%. Okay. I'm hitting the button. Button's hit. Wait. We just realized, no. I've already hit the button. It's done.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, all of that emotional baggage, it fills out the Mitchell character. I'm hesitant to do this, but in a way that O'Neill's Charlie, his son, when his son kills himself with the gun, you know, I mean, that fills out the emotional character of O'Neill. It's not addressed in most episodes, but it just sits there as part of that lattice.
Yeah.
And so getting more of that is really cool. I enjoy that. I'm appreciative of that. Also, the episode is fine. It's not bad.
It's not bad.
It, you know, I mean, I do appreciate that it is Varric who comes on to Mitchell and pushes that romantic relationship forward.
Sure.
Did it have to be there? No, it was fine. But in many other situations of this in sci-fi and rather, it would be Mitchell pushing that on there.
Sure.
And so, you know, I just appreciate that it's not that. It's a, you know, so she has agency in there. Mm-hmm. I appreciate the acting that was done by Ben Browder and the woman who plays Varric. When we're seeing the memory of Varta at the very beginning, who clearly steps too close to her and gets smarmy and gross, and she gets uncomfortable, and just the way the actors played that, and they played it well, and Ben Browder played that in such a way that it was very clear from the get-go, even though I didn't know what was going on, that whatever was going on, that wasn't actually Cam Mitchell doing this.
Right.
It was something else, someone else. You know, so that just kind of, those layers were, you know, I thought they were done well.
Yep.
And when it's all said and done, we've met a new planet that has technology, you know, similar to Earth, different, you know, better in some places, less good in other places.
Yep.
Relatively isolated in the galaxy. That makes sense. We apparently have access to some sort of memory machine now, which is interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, at what cost? But yeah, we do.
You know, it's the type of thing that, you know, if it is not abused, and of course, Teal'c makes this comment, right? These types of technologies seldom don't get abused.
Mm-hmm.
If it's not abused and it is used as a teaching tool, it could be profoundly powerful and impactful. You know, if I can somehow get your memories, and I'm going to use that word loosely, because I don't, it's not just a block of text. It's not building blocks. It's this wibbly wobbly, timey wimey, goopy lattice stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But if I can somehow take that, your experiences, and put it in my head, now, all of a sudden, I can become a much better data analyst and records keeper than I am.
Sure.
And, you know, if I don't want to be a records keeper and records analyst, then who cares?
Right.
But, you know, if I want to be a fighter pilot, right, it costs a lot to train a fighter pilot.
Yeah.
And when they die, all of that experiential memory is lost.
Yeah, unless they documented it.
Well, even when they document it, it's not. So here's the thing, is that documentation is different than getting, like, I'll use being a pastor as opposed to being a fighter pilot, because I have experience being a pastor. I don't have experience being a fighter pilot.
Right.
I go to seminary and I got 5 years. For me, it was 5 years. Other people do it in less. I was slow. But it took me 5 years to learn the documentation of how to be a pastor.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
But it wasn't until I became a pastor and started actually doing it myself that I had, A, any idea what I was actually doing, and B, actually learned, like knowing what to do to be a pastor and knowing how to do it are different.
And I think, so this is my point. I'm going to push back against it. You didn't learn how to be a pastor. You learned how to be your version of a pastor, which is fine. And it's good. And it's, you know, and it, that's not to differentiate it in a way of making it better or worse. It's to highlight that when you really start to examine how memory and experience function in a person, and then therefore in their abilities, and then therefore extrapolated out, which is, again, bringing it back to the really fun thing that I was enjoying thinking about.
Yeah.
You don't get jacked into the matrix and you know kung fu. That's not how it works. You learn from somebody else's conveyed understanding, either in person or through a document or whatever. But the point is that somebody else is conveying it, and then you are integrating it into your own understanding of things. Now, you know, I'm saying things that as soon as I say it, everyone's like, yeah, of course, duh. That's called learning. And that's the point, though, right? The whole thing here is that for a science fiction trope, the memory injection device, fine, we'll run with it. We have access to a memory injection device that's going to enable the training of F-18 pilots like never before. Sure, fine. You'll inject F-18 pilot inside somebody's head. Now they can fly a plane. Fine, whatever. I'm coming at it from an educator point of view. It's like, that's not how it works. That's not how your brain ends up knowing how to do kung fu. We want it to be like that. Boy, do we ever want it to be like that. But no, it actually takes the work of integrating it inside your own lived experience and bouncing it off of your own memories of your memories and building one block on top of the other. But it's not a building a block. It's adding an ingredient to the stew. And then you end up with, usually, you know, depending on the training or depending on the talent, you know, there's things. You end up in a spot where you are able to fly a plane and do a thing, or you are able to minister to a group of people, or you are able to understand how to distill and isolate information out of a blizzard of data. Like you end up getting those things through that experience. It's that 10,000 hours myth that, you know, like you got to spend so much time to become a master of something. But I lost my points. Where I wanted to go.
So the question at hand is this a device, ultimately, is this a device that conveys memories, or is this a device that conveys experience?
Right.
And those aren't, I mean, there's overlap, but they're not the
same.
There
is. Yeah, yeah.
If you can convey experience, then you can have actual practical
because it's
speeding
it's,
things up.
It's because experience is wedded to context.
Right. Right. You know, so like if it's just memories, then you've downloaded the memories into my head, and well, now I instead of spending 3 hours in the classroom, I only have to spend 15 minutes in the memories unit, and then I can go out and do the experience, because now I have, you know, you have told me what buttons I need to hit to fly a plane.
Yeah.
And now I need to go and practice flying a
plane.
Oh,
yeah.
Now,
let's have some fun. I just thought of a memory that I have of something.
Mm-hmm.
I will tell it to you straight. No experience. What's going to happen is that you and all the listeners are going to start inferring your own experience into what I'm about to say in order to create meaning. But here's the memory. Lifting and tipping a 700-pound barrel of rocks onto a board of plywood angled at 35 degrees, right? Like, okay. I'm giving you absolutely no context, and you're sitting here like, okay, well, you know, that could possibly happen in this or that. You know what I mean? Like, you're going ahead. It's fine. You're filling in what you think might be the contexts, and listeners are also filling in what they think might be the contexts, and it could be that somebody is actually correct in understanding that what I'm conveying is the experience of throwing a bunch of rock down a giant hillside onto the toe of a riverbank in order to solidify a sandbank from going into the river as it had been doing for 75 years prior. Like, it's possible that somebody got that experience correct. And why would I be bringing that up? It's because of reasons how you gotta, you know, like once you throw 700 pounds of rock down a board, if it's like 300 feet long, it's going at the water pretty fast, meaning a heck of a lot of that rock is out in the middle of the river. So you got to, you know what I mean? Like, there's reasons. Like, I could have given a whole lot of reasons why I suddenly shared that with you. But at the start of our little example, it was just a memory. It had absolutely no connection to anything at all.
So then the question becomes, even if this memory device doesn't actually convey experiences, but memories, would it be a useful teaching tool, and how much would that actually affect? So, like, we got some weirdness going on here. Like, when you tell me that memory, then I'm a third person to your memory, and now it's in my head, and now I can imagine that I'm the first person in that memory.
Yeah.
Which is very different than what happened to Mitchell at the very beginning of this episode when he experiences the memory in a first person POV experience.
Yep.
Which just gets wonky and weird, and I don't really know what to do with it. I don't want to say that the writers were being sloppy, because it's not that they were, it's just that they only had 43 minutes to work with, right? So you can't delve into all of this in such a way. But I also think that not delving into it made the episode two-dimensional.
It's every now and again, we will hit an episode in Stargate where we feel like they've bitten off more than they can chew, and we criticize it for it.
Yeah.
And it's not because we think that they did such a poor job with it. It's just that the topic that they picked, you know, it can easily just spider into something much bigger. And I appreciate how at points decisions just have to be made as to what stories you're going to tell. Right. And you're 200 episodes in, or not quite, but you know, you're 100 and something episodes into the series. And if you're trying to find novel stories to talk about, like, it can probably get a little challenging. This might be the downside of running episodic television, because you're kind of promising to the viewer that every week you're going to have something that's a bit fresh, not the continuation of a single story, but rather the exploration of a new story within the context of the show.
Right.
Sometimes you hit it out of the park. Sometimes you pick something that's quite interesting, super interesting. Let's imagine a society that can manipulate memories. How would that look? What would happen? But once you start to try to tell it and still make it an interesting story and not 43 minutes of a lecture talking about, like, you know, Zach, you and I have been talking about this for about 40 something minutes.
Yeah.
It is not anywhere near as interesting as a TV show.
Yeah. But at the same time, last week you came and saw my play production.
Yep.
I went through hours and hours and hours over several months to learn my part.
Yep.
And part of that was spending time delving into the character to think about what was the character like, not just what was the character like in this scene, but what's the character like before the show even opens? Who is this person? How does this person relate to his spouse, to his children? And building that background, none of that explicitly made it to the stage.
Yeah.
But all of that helped inform myself in how to play that character. Mm-hmm. And it was, and it made for a richer experience for the audience.
Yep.
Because they would see me do something at the beginning that they might not, people like, oh, he's doing that one thing. Okay. But then later on, you see why he's doing it, because he reveals something else about it. I'm like, oh, so this guy really is like X and Y because of that. So that background stuff really, really matters.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say that this is an episode that, in terms of memory manipulation, they probably spent as much time as they could because they're doing a TV show. They have a limited amount of time. I would have loved to had two or three extra rehearsals before we started playing, performing in front of an audience. I didn't have it, so I had to make the best of it. It turned out fine.
Oh yeah,
maybe better than fine. That's up to the audience. But I also think that this is an episode with a conceptual nugget that they didn't have enough time to do enough of the background stuff to really delve into what this means.
Yeah, I think I can imagine a situation that if they had infinite time to try to tell the story in 43 minutes, I bet they probably could have come up with something that was just gripping start to finish. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, if you have the ability to really hone a story, you could probably really explore this idea in ways that just blow your mind wide open over the course of 43 minutes. It would have been just exquisite. But that's with limitless time. Like, that's not reality.
That's not reality. But if I can get your memories in my head, does that mean I can potentially get to closer to limitless time? That's not really.
Oh, that's an interesting idea. Whoa. Huh. Yeah, because, you know, that another way of thinking. And then, of course, you know, is there a point at which a human mind just can't stuff any more ideas inside it? But
and of course, on that front, see the Fourth Horseman Part 2, because Orlin had too much in his brain. He couldn't hold on to it. And he had to forget it.
That's a really
interesting
idea. And
it ended up causing significant brain damage.
Wow. I know. I mean, it probably wouldn't work like that at all, because when we say more time, we mean more ability for an individual to ruminate on a thing. And if you shove somebody else's memories inside your head, you're not ruminating on the thing. But What an interesting idea. Could it feel like you're actually like 90 years old if you're 20 and you had a bunch of people's memories stuffed inside your head? Huh.
Well, that would be really, really interesting. And what would that do to a human?
Yeah.
We've seen other episodes where we have people whose memories are manipulated in one way, fashion or another. From the learning curve, Uron.
Yep.
You know, to the computer that rewrites people so that the world doesn't blow up or whatever.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
Yeah. See, this is why I like science fiction.
Yeah.
So much fun.
All right. It is time, however.
Yeah. Let's pivot.
And thinking about this episode, and not just simply the interesting conversation that we had on memories and experiences and all that stuff.
Yes.
But the actual 43 minutes of television that we received, that you watched and I watched, given that, what kind of Chevron rating are you going to give Collateral Damage?
Yup. I think it's fine, but it was a little bit too clonky in certain areas, and as a result, it just made me sort of like yawn through a whole bunch of it. The twist, I thought, was at least twisty enough. However, I saw the trajectory of this story from the jump. While the face of the murderer turned out to be slightly different, once that twist was revealed, it just kind of like flopped there like a fish. I did like how it was shot. I also liked how it was pretty clear that they were making some really intentional choices about what they were shooting, how they were shooting it. I was noticing that specifically with the memory sequences.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for a quick example, we have some memories looking at Cameron's face, which at first I'm like, well, that's weird. Why would you have a memory of looking at your own face? And it was because for the story, we had to believe that Mitchell did it, even though, you know, like that was a key part of how this mystery was going to be unraveling. So it was, I thought that they did quite a good job in certain aspects of it. Overall, I'm going to give this one a 4. The conversation makes me want to give it more. Thinking about how it was constructed makes me want to give it more. But the unfortunate reality of tackling something that you couldn't actually wrestle to the ground and tell a good story about it is just too strong of a thing. So 4 out of 7 for me. What about you?
Yeah.
How many chevrons do you give it?
So things I really liked about this episode. I like the character development and exploration of Mitchell. Not only in his past, but also in the present, in wherein, you know, he has this memory of having killed this woman whom he at least had physical feelings for, if not romantic, you know, more than that. Who knows? But he liked her, and then he killed her, at least he thinks. But, you know, so then the dogged push to find the truth for him, and not just to exonerate himself, but then to actually find justice for her.
Yeah.
I appreciate that whole character development. We really don't get anything in terms of development from the other three characters.
Right.
They're just there to help facilitate that. Now, that's not a bad thing. And also, they have had 8 years of time to do this kind of development. Cam has had 11 episodes.
Yes.
So, you know, I don't mind that. And they play their roles, and their roles fit well for what they're doing in this episode. And they're not being ignored overall in the season. So it's fine. I like that. I do like the cinematography of this episode. I like the sets that were done. You know, it's just the alien planet and the alien world. It was shot in such a way that it felt very familiar and very alien. I mean, it was not Earth. It was not anywhere on Earth.
Right.
But it's also another culture that is in a similar place to where Earth is technologically and all of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was very similar, but different. I really appreciate that. That's what I liked about this episode. You know, the acting from the guest actors was really, really good. I thought Atherton did a tremendous job of playing the emissary, being kind of icky and smarmy, and then just being, you know, a bureaucrat and a diplomat for his country and his people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, that I can't fault him for that. You know, I mean, he's kind of creepy at times. I can't fault him for trying to creep on his doctor subordinate. But that's not on Atherton. That's on the emissary himself. You know, so that's good. I think that they ultimately told a story that was fine.
Yeah.
So I think I'm going to go with, after all of that, a 4.5.
Uh-huh. Okay.
I'm going to give it that extra half chevron from your rating because I did like the special effects. The camera work, the double exposure, the way they filmed everything to tell the story in a jarring way, you know,
I mean,
so like whenever you watched a memory, it felt more than a dream, but less than reality.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was, and I thought the shooting of that was really good. So I'll give it a 4.5.
Yep. Very good.
There we go. We have some Facebook responses. At least one I know of. We have a comment from Paul.
Hi, Paul.
Paul says, Brent gives it a 5. Zach gives it a 5.
But very close.
Very close. They both enjoy the conversations that come up.
Yep.
Messing with people's memories, the good, the bad, and the control that could happen. This is a good episode because it gives us a more in-depth look at our new SG-1 leader.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. I totally agree that this is a good episode in that it gives us more depth on the SG-1 leader.
Yes.
I think it's a fascinating episode because it tells us more about you know, it gives us an opportunity to talk about memories and all of that stuff. But not quite as high as fives.
Correct. But still pretty dang close.
So pretty
well
good.
Done.
Yeah, well done. That's what we have on the Facebooks.
All right. Over on the Discords, we have some things here. We've got Kriamisk. Hi, Kriamisk.
Hi, Kriamisk.
Kriamisk says, doesn't this feel like an earlier in the series episode? Go to planet, get screwed by the inhabitants. Yeah, I agree. Leave. Brent, a 3, and Zach, a 3.5. So again, close.
Oh, wow, yeah.
And got the split, the difference between us, exactly right.
That's right.
I liked it just a little bit more. All right. Then we have Jenny Dean Anderson.
Hi, hello, Jenny Dean.
Not a personal favorite. I also want to call this one skippable, but the episode does give a little insight into Mitchell's childhood and some pretty gnarly combat memories from early in his career. Plus, the emissary is that guy from Die Hard and Ghostbusters. Zach, a 4.5.
Oh.
Right on the money. And Brent, a 3. Oh, super close.
Oh, so close.
So close. And then we've got Kevin.
Hi, Kevin.
Hi, Kevin. Kevin says, hi, Brent. Hi, Zach. This time is not a favorite of mine, but I've seen it so many times, maybe it's more enjoyable on the first watch. In fact, whenever someone mentions the title, I can never remember what episode this is until they describe the plot. Anyway, while I was trying to put myself in the shoes of a first-time watcher, I took a few notes. 1. Finally, a civilization that seems more advanced than us in some ways, and they use the gate too. Yeah, yep. There was a lot of parallels, but yeah, I mean, I was also kind of like, yeah, there was a little bit of, well, certainly of the memory thing.
Yep.
2, whenever I go to another planet, I never end up kissing anyone. Yeah. Yeah. I'm not James T. Kirk either. 3, you go to a planet where they have just demonstrated their ability to manipulate memories, and then you're going to trust your memory of doing something completely out of character and then confess to it. Yes, that's solid. That points to the meh of the episode, I think.
Yeah.
4, at least this planet has the death penalty. Okay. All right. I don't know if that's a least thing, but there we go.
Yeah.
Number 5, it's interesting to get some backstory on Mitchell. I agree. This episode has a few moments, but I find it overall pretty boring. I'm going to guess a 4 from Zach.
Close.
And a 5 from Brent. Very close. Very close.
Very close.
Since he doesn't already know the ending, I've got to go to bed now, or staying up this late is going to have ripple effects on my sleeping pattern for the next weekend. See you next time. That was Kevin. Thank you, Kevin.
Thank you, Kevin.
Then we have Sean. Hi, Sean.
Hi, Sean.
Sean says, I'm not sure I fully remember this one, but the world reminds me of the Ashen from an earlier episode.
It's called
the Ashen. Excuse me. Yes. From an earlier season. Saying that, I didn't feel the urge to pick up my phone, so it must have drawn me in. One thing when Mitchell goes back to her apartment, she says he knows where the drinks are as he's been there before in memory. Well, they're right in front of him on the shelf, so it's not hard. So, yes, Sean, so, exactly.
So here's, I didn't talk about this before, but I'll bring this in here just a moment. Right. The only memory he has of being in her apartment was with the emissary during, you know, his memory of telling. So I have walked into many people's houses.
Uh-huh.
I've had many conversations with many people. And then I've left.
Yep.
And I had no idea where they kept the drinks.
Yep.
What was emissary Varta doing there? Such that he would actually know with certainty where the drinks are.
That, and why was he there when the good doctor had to put on a night robe?
Yeah.
There was a lot about that scene that was like a little like, what? What? You just let yourself in? What? Like, huh? There was a lot of confusion. I was confused. But yeah. I'm with Sean, though, of like, I mean, that's honestly, I think that's an example of how they just didn't have enough time to kind of think it for a minute. Because seriously, have your characters continue to walk into the set. Fine, walk by the bar. Who cares? Have that statement happen in the kitchen or something. You know what I mean? Like just have it happen somewhere else in the set. And now it becomes much more powerful than it happening in front of the bar.
Yeah.
Or if it's supposed to be ironic, or you know what I mean? If there's supposed to be a bit of a joke in there somewhere, then change the line just a little, you know, to make a joke about how, you know, you should remember where the bar, but, you know, here it is. Something, but whatever. Anyway.
Yeah.
What's done is done. It's in the past. It's now, it's just a memory of ours now.
Yeah. What else does Sean has say?
Sean concludes saying, it's probably a four Chevron episode as it doesn't account to any longstanding storyline and we're not really doing filler episodes these days. Yeah, so quite close. Got mine, almost got Zach's. Well done.
Yeah.
But that is what we've got on the Discords.
Okay.
What do we have in the emails?
We do have an email from none other than David.
Hello, David.
David starts with telling us that I have a memory of this Chevron encoding bias buffer.
Uh-huh, yep.
Despite having never used this one before.
Oh, yes, of course.
I don't know. I think you have used that one before, but that's just my memory.
Here's the thing, Zach. You know how we could know that with certainty?
Documentation?
We could just go over the documentation.
You know what I'm not going to do?
Oh, no. I hear you. Nobody said that you had to do it. I'm just saying you could.
All right, here we go. I think I remember liking this one a bit the first time I watched it, but that could be a memory implant because this time I was just meh.
Yep.
Or maybe it was a modified memory from when Star Trek Voyager had nearly the same story. Yeah, that's true.
Mm-hmm.
Either way, this time I felt this was an unimaginative filler episode that really goes nowhere and does nothing. The background information for Cameron Mitchell was only there to service the plot, and prior to this, we didn't even know that he had any background trauma that he needed to work out, like what was shown. And the ending where the whatevers from that planet just changed the murderer's memory so he could continue his work, and everyone will pretend like he didn't kill his ex/important science person. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. The good stuff about this episode was the science tech and the memory playback stuff. That was cool. And the whole can your memories be trusted thing was sort of interesting. The general story, though, no. Mm-hmm. Brent, three chevrons, because at least they are giving some time for the Ori story to simmer in the background.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Yeah. Zach, 3.5 chevrons, but it might be a Mandela effect from the last time he watched it and remembered it differently.
Yeah, that's the nature of memories, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. So that was David.
Thank you, David.
Thank you. Thank you all for your predictions.
Thanks,
and your
everybody.
Thoughts. Brent.
Yes.
We are now ready to turn our attention to the next episode.
Okay. Yes.
And as Kevin snuck in there, this episode is called Ripple Effect.
Yes.
So tell me all about Star Trek SG-1's Ripple Effect.
All right. Next time on Stargate SG-1, the SG-1 team travel through the gate to find themselves on a strange world. They do their very best to create as much documentation as they need in order to review the data that they collect from this visit, as they understand that memories are fallible. They take this documentary evidence back to the SGC and they begin to analyze it with sophisticated methodology. They take readings from the various probes that they have sent into the various parts of the planet and compile a profound understanding of that the planet has peculiarities in certain regions, aspects of it that don't seem to line up with other aspects in meaningful ways. They take the photographic evidence that they have collected of the strange glyphs carved into the sides of rocks right next to where the gate is. In some respects, they are quite complex, and in other respects, quite rudimentary. It indicates a society that has evolved to create complex meanings, but still clings to the old simplistic ways that represented the earliest parts of their societies. And they carefully review the video evidence captured by the MELP and the UAV and other video capturing devices that chronicle the exploration while also providing additional insights into aspects that they missed when they were just walking around. Because, as we know, memory can be fallible. And it is this last aspect of documentary evidence that catches the eye of one Dr. Daniel Jackson as he is reviewing it, and he says to himself, this could use a little more pizzazz. So he swings his chair around, and he saddles up to an Apple, a power PC Apple.
Oh, wow. Oldie-timey.
He loads up his favorite piece of software for adding a little bit of pizzazz. He loads up Video Toaster. And he takes the video that he has shot and he loads it into Video Toaster. And he doesn't want the scenes to be simply cut splices. He wants them to be ripple effects. There's the joke. That's the end of it. Join us next time on Stargate SG-1, where Daniel's given a presentation in the briefing room and he's using ripple effects with his Video Toaster software.
Well, let me say two things.
Yeah.
One.
Uh-huh.
That is not the story of Ripple Effect. However, number two.
Oh, the episode. Okay, yeah.
Yes. Number two, in the grand multiverse of the universe, right?
Sure.
There is a universe where that is the plot line for the episode of Ripple Effect.
I'd watch that.
I'm sure you would. Shall we watch the promo?
Yes.
I am hitting play now.
Next time on Stargate SG-1.
Beauty shot.
The SG-1 team returns guns. From a mission, only to find that the SG-1 team has already returned.
We've seen this episode.
It was the one with the androids. A different SG-1 team returns from a completely different mission.
Oh. Huh? What the hell's going on?
As more and more SG-1 teams return to Stargate Command, the situation becomes increasingly complicated as old friends and familiar faces also return.
You and your team gated to a parallel reality. This is an alternate SGC on an alternate Earth in an alternate universe.
Will it be possible to return all the SG-1s to their home universes?
SG-1s.
Find out next time on Stargate SG-1.
At least you didn't say SG-1s.
That's better than one.
Unscheduled off-world activation.
Oh, boy. Is this why you were mentioning the multiverse situation there, Zach?
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Well, I'm looking forward to this one.
Yeah, that's Ripple Effect.
Yeah, that's definitely more than just the Android version.
It is. We have been to multiverses and we've seen other SG-1 people. And now we get to see even more SG-1 people.
I would find it delightful, though, if Harlan was the reason why there's all these SG-1s.
Well, that's an option. And I'm sure that there is a multiversal reality out there where Harlan is the reason for all these ripple effects.
Come try ya!
We'll have to wait and see to find out whether or not this is one of those multiversal universes.
Sure. Okay.
All right. Well, dear listeners, tell us what you think about what we just said about the episode Collateral Damage. You can email us at walkingthroughthestargate@gmail.com. You can, of course, go to the Facebooks or the Discords or anything and have conversations about memory and how memory works and doesn't work and how it should work and can't work and where the episode got it right and wrong or where we got things right and wrong. Did we miss anything? All of those fun things. You can do that by having conversation in the various social places.
Yes.
Or just talk to your friend who's next door to you. And if they have no idea what you're talking about, just, you know what, why don't you listen to the podcast?
Yes.
And
you
then
can find
you,
it.
Yes.
On Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio Podcasts, Amazon Podcasts, et cetera, et cetera. Spotify Podcasts.
And podcast alligators everywhere.
Which is the right way.
And the right way isn't the only way.
But it is the right way.
And with all of that, I say I'm Zach.
And I'm Brent.
And this has been Walking Through the Stargate. See you next time.
Bye.
Carter, dial it up. Get these people home.